I noticed today the blacks are having a demonstration march in Cleveland. I guess they do it once a year, pointing out the black-on-black crime. And they were upset because the media didn't show up. Of course the media is not going to show up. The media doesn't really give a shit about whites or blacks. But they will, as long as whites still have some power in this country, they will cater somewhat to them. But in reality, they're corporate powers, and they don't care anything about blacks or whites. They only care about money and money and power, man. That's it. You know, the National Review is a Republican-type magazine. Conservative, conservative. And it's funny how they come up on the backside and say how much they care about the blacks. Big article on the internet about that. It's funny because they don't really fool the blacks, but they fool a lot of white people. They are just another tool in the toolbox of the power structure, and they intend to keep it that way. So if you want to go out and join the right wing and the conservative Republicans thinking you're going to save your race, forget it. You're on your own, boys and girls. The rats seem to be jumping ship in the Democrat Party. In the 2016 campaign, there was no one more loyal to Hillary Clinton than her one-time Senate colleague, Chuck Schumer. He defended his fellow New Yorker and the race she ran at every turn, which makes what Schumer said about Clinton over the weekend all more intriguing. Yeah. When you lose to somebody who has 40% popularity, you don't blame
Hillary Clinton.
Wait a minute.
Do you think that she should be more engaged in the email?
Oh, I don't know. I'm going to, I think Hillary's great.
Well, I got interfered with there. Anyhow, what he said was, when you lose to somebody who has 40% popularity, you don't blame other things. Comey, Russia, you blame yourself, unquote. Schumer the Jew, the top friend of Hillary, has turned on Hillary. Historically, this is the way it works. Schumer, the top-ranking Democrat in the Senate, told the Washington Post over the weekend, quote, "So what did we do wrong? People didn't know what we stood for, just that we were against Trump and still believe it," unquote. Remember that Clinton has laid her defeat on the 2016 election directly at the feet of Russia's meddling via a series of hacked emails and then FBI Director James Comey's decision to reopen the investigation? Wow. Into Clinton's private email server? "I take responsibility for every decision I make, but that's not why I lost," Clinton said. Clinton told Recode's Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg in early June in a May interview with CNN's Christine Amanpour. Clinton said, "I was on the way to winning until a combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks raised doubts in the minds of the people who were inclined to vote for me, and I got scared off, and they got scared off," unquote. Schumer's comment to the Post are a direct rebuke of the idea that Clinton has pushed since the election. That she lost because of factors entirely beyond her control, not because of any flaw in her as a candidate of the message she ran on. Stronger Together was her quote. Schumer's arguing that Clinton lost because she ran a campaign devoid of any real message other than "I'm not Donald Trump." Schumer is also saying that if the Democrat Party wants to succeed in future elections, Democrats need to understand they didn't lose the White House because of Russia and Comey alone. He has some self-interest in making that argument. After all, Jew Schumer, interviewed with the Post, was to preview the rollout of America's 2018 message, a better deal. There's no better way to get some attention for a new message you cooked up than slam your party's previous message, and the messenger. There you go, boys and girls. The rats are turning on each other. Now, do you think Hillary's going to blast that Jew? I doubt it. She knows where she stands with the Jews. Well, let's go back a ways, maybe back 20 years or so. Little things I've picked up out of my archives here. This one's about Jeremy Reinemann, who was one of our friends and associates in the L.A. area who was gunned down by Mexicans. And he was from the waist down. He didn't have any control. Maybe a little control above the waist, but that's about it. So this is John Metzger talking to a reporter about it. After Reinemann was arrested, supposedly in a plot to blow away some blacks in a church or something, which he wouldn't be capable of doing at all. But it's also part of a situation where some guys thought they knew more than Tom Metzger and John, and they went out on a crazy deal and conspired with two known FBI agents that we already knew they were FBI informants and had told these people, we warned all these people in L.A. to stay away from these guys. But as happens, five or six people at least went along with this conspiracy, and they all got busted.
This is Jibby with the Times. I was trying to reach either John or Tom Metzger. I was wondering...
Hi, Jibby, this is John.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Hi, fine.
I saw the tape, and it was great.
Okay.
There's a lot of really good information about the shooting and everything in there. One thing I was curious about, I had understood that he was a quadriplegic, but on the tape it says that he's paralyzed from the hip down.
Yeah, he has movements within his arms, and when I saw him about 2-3 months ago, he was able, his back was a lot stronger. He could pretty much, he used to have to strap himself in, but he's, at times his back almost like goes out to where it just, he can't hold it up straight. He doesn't have any control. But he can use his arms, but he's not really, he can't really open his fists up. His fingers aren't really usable. I mean, he could wave his arms around pretty darn good.
Okay.
Because he lifts a little weights, but he can't open up his fingers to really grab anything. So he has to be, you know, fed manually and things like that.
You know, so he can't feed himself.
No, he can't. He has to be fed.
Okay. You know, at the time of the incident in the arrest affidavit, that would have been in 1991.
Okay.
Do you remember or do you know if his arms, if he could use his arms then?
Oh, if anything, they were worse than what they are now. See, he's been going through therapy. So if anything, the latest time, or the last time I saw him about 2 or 3 months ago, with it, I mean, he looked really good compared to what I've, you know, seen him do. He's been in a wheelchair. Back in 91, he would have been strapped in because he would just, his whole body would fall forward.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't have any control.
Uh-huh.
He could move his arms a little bit. He may have just been beginning, knowing a little bit about how he was going through rehabilitation. He may have been lifting a little weights with his arms.
Uh-huh.
But there's straps that strap, I believe, around his wrists, and
okay.
He was just lifting up, trying to build up his arms.
All right. But can you hold on one
second? Sure.
You know, one thing I was real curious about, do you know how long or he has been in the White Area Movement or how he got involved or anything like that?
Well, the first time I met him, and the only time was at a studio recording. He was helping out the band, essentially set up, you know, and make sure there weren't any problems. But they were in a studio, and that's where I met him, and I didn't really remember that until someone brought it up to my attention, because when the incident happened, we didn't know him that well when he was shot. And, of course, we were expressing interest, and we went up and saw him to give him our support. Well, all of a sudden, we were talking, and we found out, hey, you know, you met me once way back when. And he said, oh, yeah, okay, now we remember you.
When was that?
That would have been, gee whiz, that probably was anywhere from probably a half year to maybe a year before he was shot.
Well, is that, you said he was helping the band set up? Which band was that?
It was a band, let's see, it was called, they were called the Boot Boys.
Boot Boys?
And it was a skinhead band.
Uh-huh.
And they were in studio just playing to some of their friends and also trying to record some of their music. And they wanted to invite us up to take some video to see if somehow we can get, you know, encourage a music video or something like that. And so we went up, and unfortunately the videotape didn't turn out the way it was supposed to.
Now, was Jeremy part of that band?
Or? No, he was just on the sidelines. And a lot of bands have a group of guys that go around with them from, you know, from concert to concert to kind of help them out, help them carry stuff around, encourage them, and are there to listen to the music and support their friends. But no, he didn't have anything to do with the music.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so he was. What was the studio?
The studio, I believe, was in, you know, I'm tempted to say Cyprus, but I may be thinking that that's where they were from. Unfortunately, I wouldn't know exactly. It's been so long.
Well, I was wondering, so did you ever hear from him how he got involved or anything like that? Or I'm wondering, I'm trying to remember how old he is, but he must be about 24, I think, now, right?
He might be. I don't know, because the times I've seen him in the past, I've always regarded him as someone who was of drinking age, and there had been times where they finally had a party. It was probably a year or two back that he turned old enough to drink, and it surprised me because I was there, and I just always assumed he was over 21. He looked it.
Yeah, well, in fact, here, I'm going to pull out the affidavit here because I think that the affidavit gives their date of birth.
Yeah.
And because I was trying to remember, I think he went to high school in, here it is. His date of birth is 71.
So that'd be 3 years younger than me, about 22 or 23.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's about right, about a year or so ago. When
July 14th of 1971 is his birthday. So he's probably 22 now. And so in 1989, when this incident happened, that was 4 years ago, so he was 18.
Well, if that happened July 14th, all this thing in L.A. happened on his birthday then, because it broke Thursday morning, I believe. And that would have been July 14th on his birthday.
That's right.
That's interesting.
That is right. That's interesting. I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah.
On the tape, this woman there, is that Jill?
Yeah, Jill. She looks quite a bit like is her name Shelley Duvall, or the one that played with Jack Nicholson in The Shining? And
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, she looked just like her, because everybody used to tell her that she looked a lot like her, and she used to get a little annoyed.
and the baby, I guess, is her baby, the one that she's holding.
Yes, that's Ian, and that's by another gentleman.
Because I know she had like two or three kids.
She may have two or three, but I only know of one.
Okay. Now, there was a friend that he mentioned being with him that night. His name was Jeff.
His name is Jeff Weaver. In some of the footage that the media took up there, they showed Jeff Weaver in a police car. And I think the reason why they threw him in jail was because what happened was when these kids were running back across the street and through a park to go to their home to get some help because they were vastly outnumbered. There was just three of them, uh-huh. and they were shooting at them. The guys at the party heard shots and thought that someone was outside doing a drive-by shooting, mm-hmm. and allegedly someone inside, I'm assuming the cops pretty much thought Jeff Weaver, or maybe he admitted to it or something, was shooting back in the air somehow to just let them know. This is from what I heard, that mm-hmm. he was just want to let them know that they had guns so the guys would just leave. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, the police, I don't know if that was exactly what happened, but I know Jeff Weaver definitely wasn't doing anything wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was in the party, so mm-hmm. they must have got him for that, you know, weapon, some mm-hmm. type of weapon, shooting weapons off in the city. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he's the one, if you look through any footage, he's in the car. Uh-huh. And some of them think that he was Jeremy. I know, I think I saw a couple of people say that they thought he was Jeremy. Mm-hmm. But Jeff Weaver is on video. He was just one of these skinheads. That,
would he have known Jeremy for a long time?
I don't know about a long time, but I know that, you know, I believe he knew him for, well, I really can't say, actually. I really just don't know, to be perfectly
uh-huh.
honest.
Because, uh-huh. I think I may have interrupted you, but I was wondering if he had known how he might have gotten involved in the movement, because he was a member of the movement during the, while he was in high school.
When he was or he wasn't?
I think he was.
Okay. I'm not quite sure. Going back to high school, that may, well, of course, his haircut. Well,
yeah,
he sure had a cut like a skinhead. He probably was. Mm-hmm. I just wouldn't know.
You don't know how to get in touch with Jeff, do you?
Jeff, no. He's in L.A., and unfortunately, he was just involved with a lot of guys that I chose to stay away from.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, some of these skinheads just want to have their own neighborhood thing, and
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of against any attempt of organized anything. You know, it's kind of disappointing, so
yeah.
we're not too interested in Jeff.
Now, one thing I think that your father told me is that Jeremy had left the Church of the Creator.
Yes, he had formally resigned, I believe, in June when, from what I heard, that Mr. Allen had wrote the letter. Somehow, Mr. McCarty, who runs the church, either confronted him or just a combination of issues, and Jeremy quit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, well, of course, I think I saw that in some type of news article. But I think someone said June 10th or something, if I recall.
Well, June 10th was the date on the letter that Mr. Allen sent to the church that was reprinted in the newsletter.
Oh, okay.
That was the date of the letter, and that was where he was referring to Jeremy and called him a spoiled brat or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, denying to charge the rumors of vicious lies being spread against him.
Oh, okay, then maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Do you know how he? I don't know how much contact did you have with Jeremy after the shooting?
Oh, after the shooting, when that happened, we felt really bad. Even though we had only met him once, and even then, that was just another guy in a room. You know, I don't even remember talking to him. I'm assuming I did when we were in the studio, but I was busy videotaping and stuff like that. But I'm trying to think of. I'm sorry. The question was.
How many times did you see him? Oh,
after, well, when he got shot, we were. You know, we saw him at the hospital. We felt bad. You know, we wanted to show him that we, you know, support him. We thought it was a bad deal, especially the way some of the press was handling it. And you know, a guy was almost dying, and we felt, you know, pretty bad for him. And normally, we don't, you know, go out of our way sometimes to. You know, go up to the L.A. area, but in this case we did, and, mm-hmm. and we saw him, and gradually we just developed a relationship, and at the time he was expressing, you know, thanks, because you know, he had a lot of support from the skinhead community at the time. It was gradually wearing off. It's one thing to go to the hospital and say, hey, you know, we support you, and, you know, maybe leave a magazine or something,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, after a period of time, just a lot of his friends, you know, just weren't, they were just went about their daily life and never really helped them out. But I think one of the reasons, that's right, one of the reasons why we kind of got close was because he figured, well, since he was a, you know, well, at the time, a quadriplegic, I mean, barely living, he was able to, you know, breathe, and but he was laying down at all times. He had his head brace on, like you saw in the video. He couldn't do much. We bought him a Walkman and some headphones, and brought him in some tapes. We would copy some videotapes to audio and just stuff to keep him busy. Some types of music, but I think it was more just interviews, something to take up his time while he was healing. Yeah, that's right. And he really enjoyed that because
were these commercial videotapes or from the movement?
Or just probably a combination of both. Probably most of our footage, but actually just at the time, I remember just gathering anything that he would at least have to listen through to see if he liked it or not. But it was just something where, you know, you're obviously going to want to take your attention off, you know, just laying down, and he was doing it for several weeks. So that's right, we did buy him a Walkman and put it in there, and he was listening to tapes, and he was he liked that a lot. And we got him a headset for his phone he could plug into the hospital, so he wouldn't have to I think he just had to push a button. I think he had some type of use with his arm, because I think he was able to push a button or something. But he was able to speak on the phone a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's right. And after that, I think he really felt like we helped him out a lot. And it was there that he, I think he got a little bit disillusioned with the skinhead scene. And this is, of course, just my perception, because some of them were just going off and screwing around and not really doing much. And I'm on a phone. Oh, I got some crisis going on.
Oh.
So, you know, he knew who his friends were, the ones who were coming by paying attention to him and stuff like that. And he liked that. So he really liked us because, you know, we put our money where where the mouth was. You know, we came and assisted him. And
how was it for him? Because my understanding is that one of the things that kind of allowed this informant to make his way was that Jeremy was needing money. And this guy was helping him with grocery money, I guess. And rent.
Yeah, that was a bad situation. We tried, we had associates in the area that, and others that we knew of that were trying to take a bag of groceries as often as they could to him, because they were living off of, I believe, the state, which wasn't much. And, let's see, after the time when they were coming to an apartment, of course, his common-law wife, you know, obviously she couldn't go out and work, and I don't believe she did before, but she had to stay and take care of him and also raise a kid, and it was very stressful, and there wasn't really much money from the state. I forget exactly how much that is, but I remember that they were eating, I remember distinctively, you know, we'd always go in there and we'd make it a point of, you know, going in the refrigerator, making sure it was full, because it would usually be stacked with potato. It sounds like a sad story, but it sounds like kind of twisting a little bit, but literally they just had potatoes and, I mean, just the bare necessities, and we just wouldn't, you know, we didn't like that. So so we tried to bring in groceries as often as possible. And but see, they weren't making much, and that's probably, and we tried to slip them a 20 every once in a while, and people would try to help them out, maybe pay a utility bill or something like that. And,
Was this when they were living in Fullerton?
I believe so, yes. Well, yeah, in Fullerton. Mm-hmm. That's when I was was over there quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And so
do you think that he was pretty vulnerable then? I don't mean vulnerable in general, but vulnerable,
yeah, I know what
to
you
the
mean.
Advances from
yeah.
this guy.
Well, I'll put it this way. $400 would have really made his day, and I don't think he would have turned it down. Now I think he would, but back then $400, I'm sure, was close to paying rent.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was one of those tight situations.
Then when did he leave Fullerton? Was that when he and Jill separated? And I think your father was saying that she went to live with her parents, and he was thinking of going to live with his parents or something.
They split up, and obviously, you know, it's a very stressful situation. I mean.
Mm-hmm.
If you're essentially basically almost quadriplegic. There's things that are, you know, you have to do that are pretty grotesque because you don't have any control, and his wife would have to help him out. And, you know, she's just young and had a child to raise, and I could see where it just built up after a while. From my own observation, they split up.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about 2 years ago?
You know, I don't know. I would say a little less than that, maybe a year. But I'm not really that sure. He was just, I haven't seen him that often in the last year. Because I've just been real busy down here. I've seen him a couple times.
Mm-hmm. And was it your understanding then that he went where? Or did you,
I believe he went east. I think he moved to Huntington Beach. Mm-hmm. And I think he moved from there to somewhere else. But mm-hmm. I've heard Corona pop up, but I think it's somewhere around there. I don't know if it's the actual Corona or not. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, because I think that your dad was one who told me that he was in Corona now.
Yeah, he could be. He could be. It's somewhere east of Orange County.
I apologize, boys and girls, but I don't have my underground bunker anymore, which was relatively quiet except for the chitter-chatter of the dogs upstairs. But we get disturbed once in a while here. I had a serviceman come in to check my furnace out, or my air conditioner. And so we had to cut off. So now we're going to go back. You know, I'm your low overhead lone wolf guy. I don't have a staff here taking care of my problems like Mr. Trump does. Now, most things I can fix myself, and I fix almost everything. But once in a while, I run into some kind of an automatic electronic problem, like with a furnace, that I just never dealt with. So that's the problem. And of course, the dogs, too. They chirp up anybody comes around, and I got to deal with dog noise. You can edit out this BS. You don't need this.
Or who takes care of him?
I think so. I'm not quite sure. I mean, when I call him, he answers the phone all the time with his headphones and the loudspeaker. So I'm not quite sure who's really taking care of him. It could be some other friends. I don't know. It could be his parents. You know, it could be one or the other. I mean, I'm assuming it would be either friends or parents.
Yeah. Well, how has he sounded to you recently when you've talked to him on the phone? How are his parents?
Oh, well, I think he realizes that the impression I get is that he knows this is something ridiculous. He can't really express too much of even what he would like to me because, you know, he, you know, his attorney doesn't want them to really talk about much until they figure out, you know, what the heck's going on. And, of course, they're interested in their civil suit, too, and they don't want this to disrupt that either.
Mm-hmm.
And so he hasn't really expressed too much, but just the fact that he appreciated that, you know, we all had made contact and at least wanted to make sure everything was okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did he tell you how the FBI reacted when they walked in and saw him?
I think I heard from my father, maybe someone else, that they were just kind of surprised when they walked in. But I don't know that firsthand or from him. But I think it was my father that made.
Yeah, he did mention that to me. I do remember that he did tell me that.
Okay.
Do you know when he was supposed to go meet with his attorney today?
No, unfortunately not. But I wouldn't think anything would come out of it until this evening if, you know, someone could contact him.
Mm-hmm.
But I know it sounds a little maybe paranoid or something, but we try to control some of the phone calls we make because we've been in some weird situations before.
Right.
You know, they're trying to link us to something, and I just wouldn't doubt if, you know, they subpoena our records, and before you know it, you know,
mm-hmm.
here we go telling Jeremy,
mm-hmm.
this is what you did good, and this is what you did bad.
mm-hmm. Right. I understand. Is there anyone you can think of who might have known him prior to the shooting? I mean, the only person I can think of is this guy, Jeff, and I'm wondering if there's, or, you know, anyone who might. I'm kind of curious to find out, you know, how he became, you know, politically involved.
Yeah, me too. It's probably more of a statement. I know a lot of ex-punk rockers got into the skinhead scene. I don't know exactly his story, but I believe that was probably his case. Or maybe he just went straight into a skinhead I don't know if I'm confusing him with another skinhead, but I believe he had fairly good, well, I think Channel 4 covered that he was a presidential candidate, or they had a special, you know how you have your students that very high marks in grades, and they put them in a class, you know, a percentage, and they give them a certain title. It slips me. I've been out of high school for so long.
I just, you know, like if you're a top student, that you get some, you're recognized.
Yeah, it's like a presidential something, or there's another one, I can't think of it, but anyway, his school records, I believe, showed him to do very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you're right, and I think I did see that, but I can't remember now where. He was supposed to be a really good student.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of anyone else who might, because since he has moved around, I don't even know if he was born in Orange County or if he...
Yeah, me neither.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Well, let me think. If there is anything that, if you can find out his, you know, his attorney's name, obviously, I think
okay.
We're interested in that. At least talking to the attorney, because he may know some of this background information, too. I was wondering, you know, what were the kinds of things that he liked? Like the tapes, for example, other than the tapes of movement, was there a particular kind of music that he liked? Was it punk rock?
Oh, well, I think he liked, I think he ran the gamut, just like all of us, you know, we have different music that we like, but he seemed to concentrate quite a bit on actually skinhead music, which, you know, all types, you know, from England and America, which is kind of strange because most skinheads, you know, get a lot into you know, heavy metal and different types of music and also skinhead music, but he concentrated primarily on skinhead music.
Mm-hmm.
I remember every time we'd go over, you know, he would literally almost beg us to stay. Pretty much put us through a guilt trip for leaving so soon, and we'd be there 2 or 3 hours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to get up there, you know, maybe once a month or something like
uh-huh.
that. Mm-hmm. And he put us through the guilt treatment to stay longer. So we did stay longer, as long as we could.
Mm-hmm.
But we try to encourage people to make periodic, drop by periodically instead of just having one person come by often.
Mm-hmm. So, try to see him about once a month or something like that.
It probably didn't even, I think the first couple of months it worked out that way, but after that, you know, we were quite busy, so it was kind of sporadic.
And what was kind of some of the things that he talked about? All he could do was lie there after a while, and after the shooting.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of time to think about.
Yeah, I don't remember him really talking about the incident that much. I know he expressed that when he was running, when he was shot, he essentially didn't feel anything. He just saw basically everything slowed down, and he just felt like a sack of potatoes, he said, and he didn't have any control over anything.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I don't recall him talking that much about that. I know he didn't like some of the hospital. He was in some of the county hospitals, I think the first one he went into, and it was essentially he was in a war that, you know, had a lot of shooting victims, young shooting victims, which, of course, you know, mainly gang people that have just gotten hurt in a fight or a fist fight or something. So he wasn't too encouraged with the surrounding because he was totally defenseless. Of course, being a skinhead, he didn't like being around the, you know, majority of non-whites happened to be there. And a majority of them were in gangs because I know I went in there and they'd have all their friends there, or they appeared to be.
Mm-hmm.
And
he
I know
was
he
kind of intimidated.
Yeah, I think he was a little intimidated because he had no use of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember someone I think stole his tape recorder or something one day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Okay, the money's right there in that envelope. Yeah. Anyway, so I know he wanted to get out of that, and I think finally he moved to that hospital that's on the video, that Northridge Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was shortly thereafter, after he moved in there, then he got out of there and went home. I believe that's how it went.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I think he was really upset when someone stole his tape recorder, and I'm not sure if we replaced it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something, a headphone or a tape recorder that someone stole, and it was
mm-hmm.
pretty upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I think he just liked talking to people about things. And, of course, we would always go in and joke with him. And at the time, even though the doctors definitely didn't recommend it, we'd take in, you know, maybe a beer every once in a while because he was in there a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd have him, you know, through a straw, drink a little beer, and try to relax. So I know his friends did that more than we did. But, you know, we tried to make it the best we could.
Uh-huh.
So I think after that, you know, we developed a nice relationship with him because I think he had, you know, come around full circle, you know, from, you know, what had happened. He was reflecting on his life and... Mm-hmm. You know, he was seeing who his, some of his true friends were, the ones that were visiting him, and who wasn't, things like that, the people who were helping him out, trying to help him with bills and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's how I really got more interested, or not more interested, but more knowledgeable and made an acquaintance with Jill Scarborough, because she would be there almost every time I was there, she was there. She spent quite a bit of time at his side. Mm-hmm. So when I... So, you know, obviously when we go, we'd all talk and get to know each other a little more.
This, the wedding, that they had kind of like an Aryan wedding in Oklahoma?
Yeah.
Was that before, that must have been before the shooting, right?
Yeah, he was, he proposed to Jill just hours before. See, what happened was in 1989, or about mid-1989, June or July, there was an Aryan festival in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. near Tulsa. And I was there, and I was videotaping some of the thing. Well, we edited it down, and we sent him some copies and of that so he could play. Well, he was at a party for another gentleman, and they were watching the Aryan Fest because we had just got done editing it, and we sent it up. As a matter of fact, at that shooting, me and my father were slated to go to that party, but we chose not to because of the location.
It was in the valley, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't in the best of neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is a relief, because it could have been any one of us down at that store.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so he was watching the film, and he proposed to her after they saw the two weddings that happened on video. Said, hey, you know, let's 1990 or whatever, or the next couple of years or whatever, let's get married at the Aryan Fest, you know, because it was a yearly thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did.
Was it that party that he saw the video?
Yeah, they showed the video at the party because everybody wanted to see it that wasn't able to make it back because they had skinhead bands that they'd want to see, but they couldn't afford to go way back to Tulsa.
Uh-huh.
And so they all got together around the TV, a whole bunch of them, and well, I think probably close to 50 people, and watched the video he proposed, and everybody, you know, as a basically another party for him too.
Uh-huh.
And that's probably why they ended up going down the store two or three times.
Uh-huh.
And getting beer and as the night got longer, and so the whole incident happened. And then sure enough, though, they I'm not quite sure how he afforded it or what happened, maybe someone put up the money, but they flew him out to Tulsa in 1990, which, yeah, that'd be a year after, mm-hmm. and had mid-1990, and they had a wedding there, him and Jill, and that was on videotape, too.
Oh, so it was after the shooting, then?
It was after the shooting. He was still in his wheelchair, and, you know, he wanted to go back, you know, real bad,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not quite sure how he ended up, but I know he flew back.
Mm-hmm.
And went back, and everybody back there was, he liked it back there because, you know, he saw a lot of friends that he'd been communicating with, and skinhead friends, too, that and others, families and all that were riding him. Because we, whenever something that tragic happens, we really promote, you know, a guy is, you know, it's one thing if it's a mutual fight or something, but, I mean, he was flat out just rat-packed and shot as they were running away,
mm-hmm.
and it was a sad situation, and so we really pushed everybody to help him out as much as they could,
mm-hmm.
and quite a few people rode him and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and so anyway, he went back there for two or three days and had a real good time.
That's interesting then, so that was in Tulsa.
That was near Tulsa, yeah.
Okay, well, then I didn't realize then that he had proposed to her the night of that party.
Yeah, and that's what's so tragic, and I learned that when we were talking to him over a period of time, that they had proposed and everybody at the party was happy and everything, and they were going to get married at the next Aryan Fest, which they did, but subsequently, you know, during that time, he ended up getting shot and paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
But she's still stuck by his side, so... Mm-hmm.
No, it was that wedding wasn't, like, legal, right? It was...
Well, it was a common law wedding. It was by... the gentleman's name was Joe Grego.
Mm-hmm.
at the time he was a war representative that was throwing some of these Aryan Fests and these different gatherings to kind of get all these different factions together and quit having problems over little issues and things and get them to know each other from all over the country. And anyway, so yeah, that was by Joe Grego. He was not a minister, but somehow he had the ability to, I don't know exactly how that works, but it was a common law wedding, so I don't know how that really works, because I was busy just doing videotape and other things, so I didn't.
So people got together some money and flew them over there so they could get married.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they saved up enough money. Probably not, because they were pretty darn poor.
Mm-hmm. Which is the county hospital that she first went to?
I just don't know. I could maybe track that down, but next time I talk to him. But it's just something I just don't know at the time.
Well, if you talk to him today, I would be interested in finding out, where, if he grew up in Huntington Beach or if he had just moved here, after a certain time, and how he became politically active. Because I know with everyone, there seems to be like a moment in life when they kind of meet people.
Sure.
And I'd like to know how that happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll find that out. It was probably something pretty simple. He just had a few guys at his school that happened to be that, and he just liked them and kind of graduated from that.
Right. And had he ever planned on going to college?
I'm not quite sure, to be perfectly honest.
He was such a good student.
I
wondered if the accident, the shooting, caused him to give all of that up.
I just don't know.
What he had aspired to do, I don't know.
Yeah, I just don't know.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Well, if you have a chance to ask him, that would be really great.
I will. I'll do as much as I can, and I'm also working on this other fellow that was that knows a little bit about Joe Allen, and they actually introduced him,
the other guy.
So I'm trying to get him to come out of the woodwork. He will be a witness for him, so eventually it would be public, but he's a little skittish about working with the media, so I'm trying to... I think he wants to express his thoughts through his attorney and have his attorney relay them, because unfortunately not many of us have had too good of a relationship with you guys before, but anyway, so I'll work on what I can, and I'll get back to you, but I don't think anything's going to happen today, or if anything, this evening, maybe.
Okay. All right, good. Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Sure, bye.
Now, the Jeremy Reinemann saga grew out of a situation which a lot of skinheads wanted to party all the time, and once in a while I partied with them, but there was sort of a hanger-on guy that was not 100% with us, but he sort of supported us, supposedly, and he was going to have a birthday party, but I didn't realize the birthday party was going to be more over towards East L.A. And if you know anything about L.A., you know about East L.A. And he invited John and I to come, and there's going to be quite a few skinheads there and so forth for this birthday party. Well, for some reason, we decided not to go. We didn't realize where it was at, or I definitely would not have gone, and which I didn't go. But anyhow, in the middle of the party, the boys are looking for more beer, and they go out to the local grocery store, and they're spotted, of course. They're in full, decked out in full skinhead regalia with swastikas and everything, and the gangbangers they're working in the grocery store and on the outside. And all of a sudden, they pull guns, and these guys take off running because they weren't armed, and as they were running, they were shooting at him. And one of the slugs got Jeremy Reinemann and, of course, screwed up his spine, and that's how Jeremy Reinemann got screwed up. And this is a problem. This was a problem with the skinheads all the time. They wanted to flaunt their racial feelings, which sounds good on paper, but I don't think that works anymore, because you make a target out of yourself and so forth. So we had a long relationship. He died about 2 years ago. But he had a pretty miserable life, but we supported him as much as we could. even though he got involved with some wackos up in L.A. that were supposedly in this some kind of conspiracy, and which we had, like I told you before, we had warned them. We knew who the informants were. We knew that because we made it our business to know. But most of the right-wing people, including the skinheads, they didn't look into this stuff. They didn't use their investigative powers. They didn't pull files at the courthouse. They didn't look at criminal files and things like that. We did. And we had run into these two informants, FBI informants. They came to a meeting we had down in Rainbow Valley. We used to meet down there every once in a while and have potluck on Sunday. A lot of the senior citizens came and so forth. They showed up all decked out with gold chains around their neck. And back then, it was the way they operated is they'd always have a beard and long hair. And I guess they tried to use that as a cover. But you know how you get that feeling? You better learn how to get that feeling. Right away, I said, there's something wrong here. So we treated them all right while they were there, but once they were on their way, I told everybody, don't have anything to do with these people. Well, it wasn't too long after that we heard that they were operating up in L.A., that somehow they had a warehouse. I think it was down at Long Beach. They had it all installed with video cameras everywhere, and they were inviting these skinheads down to have steaks and drink and everything, you know, giving them whatever they wanted, you know, just treating them wonderful. And I had one infiltrator who was working for me, and he was reporting back to me, and I said, these guys are bad. These guys are no good. Any of our guys that show up there, warn them off because they're bad. Well, it wasn't too much longer to where they arrested five or six of these skinheads, including Jeremy Ryman in his wheelchair, for plotting to allegedly blow up some black church, a well-known black church downtown, like that would do any good, you know, like that. That's the road to victory, right? Well, anyhow, Jeremy was involved in that, and gradually he got out of it. He had a sawed-off shotgun. That's what they charged him with. So anyhow, that's a little bit more on that particular situation. I remember they all got off quite easy compared to what it would be today. Back then, it wasn't quite as bad, but I'll tell you one thing. They used to say, watch out for the Jewish Defense League in L.A. I say, you mean LAPD? The LAPD is far more dangerous and more our enemies than even the JDL. I used to warn people all the time. That is the Jewish Defense League, the Los Angeles Police Department. Now, you remember this O.J. trial that they moved from West L.A. downtown, and that's how he got off, because it was all black jury, or mostly black. And I got a point here if I could find it. Oh, yeah. And the reason it got shifted down there is because of Ira Reiner, the district attorney of Los Angeles County, who had a special thing against skinheads or any racists or any neo-Nazis or whatever. And he was always after him. And he moved that trial downtown. He knew exactly what he was doing. Ira Reiner, a first-class son of a bitchin' Jew of the First Order. I just never understood why they, I forget their name, the father and mother of O.J.'s wife, murdered wife. Why didn't he just call one of the mob and have him take O.J. out? I'm still surprised that O.J.'s walking around. I'm surprised he made it through prison. However, I'm sure that they looked up to O.J. in the prison for getting away with murdering a beautiful white gal and getting away with it. There was a day when these things would be taken care of by the family. I remember the situations like that when I was a kid, where somebody did something really bad to a family. Well, The family took care of business. They didn't even have to call the cops. I had a high respect for, in the film The Godfather, how they took care of things in the Italian community. I had a lot of respect for that. To be perfectly honest, I fear far less from the mob than I do the government. The real mob in this country is the government. It is the FBI. It is the Treasury. It is all of these people. They're the mob, the real mob. Italian mob or the Sicilian mob, as long as you kept your nose out of their business, you were okay in most cases. And one thing I liked about the mob, too, you didn't mess around with another mobster's girlfriend or wife. That was a no-no. I'll tell you one thing, in my early days running around with David Duke, if they'd have had those kind of rules in a clan, Duke wouldn't have been around very long because he was trying to bed down with every Klansman's wife and daughter and you name it. Now I'm going to close this out with a little clip that you won't recognize very much of it, but we did have a person we worked pretty close with, Kirk Lyons, that was helping various guys who were charged with various crimes, and he supported several of them, including Richard Butler, Varian Nations, and so forth. And we worked quite closely for a while. We gradually drifted apart. I don't know exactly why, but I think I was getting too hot for him. But this is just to let you know and hear his voice. And that while, got to blow my own horn a little bit, while these other leaders were doing nothing for people who were charged with crimes, racist, we were doing our best with almost no money to help people.
Hey, I forgot to tell you yesterday, there's going to be a gal, a German gal in Florida that's going to give you a call. Maybe she has already.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Well, she had a particular situation she talked to me about, and I suggested maybe she should talk to you about it. How's that for dumping responsibility on you? But anyway...
From Germany or just has a German name?
No, she is from Germany, and okay. Her father was in one of the guys on board a U-boat and everything. But anyway, she works for a community college, she said, and she's just having problems because, there's problems because the guy happens to be quite a few Jews on the board. And this, that, and it's something, she sounds really... really nice and everything. I don't know if you can help her out or not. I just thought maybe you could hear out and see a little bit of where she was coming from. It's kind of a sorry story, but it sounds legitimate and everything.
Okay.
But like I said, it's whatever, because there wasn't much I could do to help her out. But beyond that, now I have a gal that is up in the, she was covering the Weaver trial on everything, is up around Montana and Idaho area. She said in an emergency, she can go down to Salem and pull a file if you can't, you know, get someone to do it.
Okay.
So keep that in mind. But now she was wondering, have you, and unfortunately I haven't been talking to my dad lately because we've been in and out, but missing each other. Have you and Scott touched bases?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. And
guy in Colorado?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's on vacation right now. I talked to him just before he was leaving.
Okay. And he was coming back.
He would be willing to quarterback it, but he didn't, you know, volunteer or, you know, making sure that the thing is filed properly and everything, because he's basically going to be gone.
Yeah, and he'll be gone probably, until after, pretty darn.
Until after the time is...
Okay, so essentially throughout the thing.
Yeah.
Okay, and how about his local council that he had...
He didn't mention to me anybody that... You know, I mentioned that we had the potential of one that's coming up in August.
Yeah.
And he didn't mention to me anybody in Oregon that he had.
Okay, because the gal I talked to that set this angle up, with his contacts up, said that he had an associate that, but we have no idea of where he lies on the issue anyway at the moment,
yeah.
In Portland, and she was just curious as if he expressed that to you or not. But now, wasn't Miskey's mom or stepmom a paralegal or something?
I don't know.
Now, I've talked to somebody up there, and it wasn't Pat Campbell that would go through, you know, she went through the court buildings often, and through Salem. I tried to have her pull something. She couldn't find it.
Well, if you can find a name or something, I'll be sure happy to call her.
Well, I tell you, I'm going to have to go through some paperwork and dig it out. But anyway, okay, well, I'll see what we can do. And anyway, maybe if you could work on your end, too. We'll,
okay.
But anyway, so I'll see what I can come up with. But she said in emergency she'll go down there, and she's, you know, competent. Where, I mean, anybody just needs to stumble in and just pull a case that's small, you know,
yeah.
and see how it's outlined and fax it back. So I'll work on it, and I was going to contact her today and see what was going on. So,
okay.
Anyway, we'll leave it at that.
Very good, John.
Good deal.
Okay.
Anyhow, that's all a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff with the Metzger family and what we've been involved in. And I've got a lot more of this stuff to play that you've never heard of, probably never know anything about. So that's it for today. This is Moonsday. I'll be back on Tuesday tomorrow.